Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and today we have another review from Noah and Trouble about The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1. And we have a special All Doctor Who, All the Time geek session with special guest Tim Callender and Sean Farrell, basically doing a recap of this past season of Doctor Who and a little hint of their expectations of the upcoming season and even the Christmas special. But first, here's our review from Noah and Trouble.
Welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi movie review. This is Noah Richmond.
And Trouble Making.
So today we are talking about The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1.
Yay!
I was privy to a preview screening, and I have to say I am somebody that's not read any of the books, so I had no idea what to expect. I enjoyed the first movie. I enjoyed the second one, but I was a little let down that they were doing The Hunger Games again instead of going somewhere different with the story. So this time I wasn't sure what to expect, but I was really hoping that it's not going to be The Hunger Games a third time.
Kind of.
I have to say that I was pleasantly surprised that they really went somewhere with the story, somewhere different. And overall, I really had a lot of fun with it. Certainly, it's a little funny to say fun when it's certainly a grim story. There's no doubt about that. This is one of the darker films ever to become a blockbuster. But as somebody that's enjoyed the first two, this one I honestly probably enjoyed the most of the three.
Wow.
Because for me, as somebody that had already seen Battle Royale, the Japanese film Battle Royale, I always felt that The Hunger Games itself was a little bit of a rehash.
Okay.
I know a lot of people disagree, but to me it just seemed very reminiscent, very similar. I already been there, done that in terms of the story.
Okay.
But I still enjoyed the other two. This one I enjoyed even more because it was at a same level of enjoyment and filmmaking as the other ones.
Okay.
But the story finally was doing something just completely different.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, I saw the movies first and then read the books because I like the movie so much that I was like, I want to know more about this. And what I learned is something that they explained in one of the commentaries was the fact that the book is written in first person. So it's written in Katniss's perspective. So you do not see a lot of the third person material. So they had to fill in the gaps, which is why they got the author involved. And she basically was able to say what could be seen that you don't see. And there's some things that happened in book two they had to show in book one to explain something. I felt, after reading the book Catching Fire and the movie were very comparable. They really stuck to the canon in regards to the storytelling. Yeah, there's some licenses there to tell the rest of the story. However, it did work. So, that being a surprise, because as you guys may or may not know, I really loved Harry Potter. And when I'd read the books and then I'd see the movies, it was like someone had taken the book and they chopped it all up and threw it in a blender and hit puree. When Catching Fire was released, I didn't have that feeling. So I struggled about whether or not I was going to read Mockingjay. Because I was like, oh, I kind of like the excitement of not knowing, but I couldn't resist. So I read the book. And I gotta tell you, that is one grim book. So my questions to Noah is that I kind of assumed, based on my reading of the book, where they would end the story. And he has confirmed, without spoilers, that I was pretty dead on. So if you've read the book, you probably know exactly where and when things happen. Dun, dun, dun. The end. Cliffhanger. It's the only logical cliffhanger there is. So that gives me, yay, good, not just because I guessed it, but that's where I would have left it off. Some questions I can ask without spoiling what happens in the story itself, because what I'm going to be interested to see is what parts of the story they leave out, what part of the story they introduce so that we can understand stuff, and if they've thrown anything towards the end in the beginning. I know already that they have added Effie Trinket's character. They've expanded it because apparently there was lots of commentary. They really liked her because in the book, she's not significant in Mockingjay. She's kind of towards the end. But they expanded her so that, as you said, it's a very grim tale. They said that they expanded her for comic relief. And I will be interested to see whose lines she takes, because I already know she takes one of Finnick's because of a preview. But it's appropriate for her character. Also, there's a lot of things that should have been touched on in the first two movies that are... I'm wondering if they're going to backpedal to go, oh yeah, by the way, this means that. Or if they're going to gloss over and find different ways. So, now my questions to you. Knowing what I know, and knowing that you don't know the type of person President Coin is, do you trust her?
Well, the character is definitely played to be somewhat ambivalent. On one hand, everything that she says is what you would want to hear about democracy and freedom and peace. But there is, at the same time, a little bit of a question as to who do you completely trust.
Okay. All right. That answers a lot of questions. And also asks a lot of questions. For example, knowing what you know about President Coin, if she asked you, Noah, will you be the Mockingjay? Would you be the Mockingjay for her? Or would you portray it the way Katniss has? That was not spoily.
Again, it's doesn't really come off completely clear what the long-run plan is.
Okay.
There's obviously some idea of a rebellion against a tyrannical empire and a rebellion that speaks of things like democracy and freedom. So I suppose in that respect, it sounds more appealing than a government that throws its people in the Hunger Games.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's an interesting perspective. Being the fact that I did read the book and I'm a very visual person, I had an imagination about what District 13 looked like based on some of the context of the book, stating that this is Northern America, Appalachian areas, and I knew someone that worked in Mount Weather, which was a city under a mountain, without giving too many details. How cool is District 13?
I would say that District 13 is not the most awe-inspiring visual spectacle you will ever see. It is neat. It's cool.
I have a question.
How it's been built. It's impressive that something like that could have been built under the nose of the Empire without them noticing. In fact, it's a little questionable.
One of my questions in relation to this, they're in the story and... This is slightly spoiling, but it's not spoiling enough that it'll change your plot. Did they show the elevators?
No.
Okay. That was something I wanted to see visually because I kept thinking of Stargate. The elevator down to the Stargate system. Huh. You know. Another thing. As we know, Katniss has a little post-traumatic stress when she leaves the second arena. Because, after all, she just shot an arrow into an electric grid and got herself shocked to death. And not only that, she also finds out that PETA, her fiance, was not rescued with her, and she's really mad about that. You know that at the end of Catching Fire. That being said, I know that they drugged her on the hovercraft. I know that she's got a lot of post-traumatic stress. Is that obvious? Does she play strung out Katniss?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's not a spoiler at all, because that's the very beginning of the film. Okay. She's completely traumatized.
Yeah. And that's another thing. I'm very interested to see what parts they do keep true, what parts they change up. You and I had a discussion about the game master being dead.
Yes.
And he is a significant role throughout the whole entire story. It'll be interesting to see what they're going to spend a year trying to make up for. I related it to when Harris, gosh, his name escapes me.
No, when you say the game master, you mean Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yes, correct. Uh-huh. God rest his soul. Let's go back to Harry Potter. The Harry Potter in me is always there. When Richard, I believe it's Richard Harris, who played...
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, Richard Dumbledore.
Originally played Dumbledore, who couldn't be more perfect for Dumbledore, passed away. Before they selected his replacement, there was talk of CGI. of they were going to CGI Dumbledore, and I was like, oh my god, that's going to be awful. And I'm really glad they got a replacement. However, this doesn't have the same longevity that Harry Potter had, because we're talking about the end of the story. I think they might do, and this is just speculation, what they did with the Crow when Lee died. And they did a lot of, they got a brother, or it was his brother or some actor who, I'm thinking of Leah.
Right. Anyhow. My understanding with Mockingjay, what they're going to do for part two, uh-huh. is just, they had already shot almost everything they needed. They only had one or two scenes left that they needed with him. And that what they're doing is giving that dialogue to other characters is how they're going to handle it.
Mockingjay is PG-13.
Yes, that was a very interesting. I was watching that thinking, wow, so this gets a PG-13, and when I saw The Conjuring, that film, nobody died, there was almost no gore,
mm-hmm.
and yet it got an R rating.
See, that makes me surprised, because I know the ending of Mockingjay.
And meanwhile, yeah. I saw what I saw on the screen...
Was really?
Well, I'm not going to say they go over PG-13, but it is definitely pushing the bounds of...
Well, the story itself has a lot of what I consider... Now, I come from a different generation, I admit, I'm dating myself, that I considered very R-rated material, and I remember reading it going, oh gosh, because I'm a visual thinker, and I visually saw this. So I was like, huh, they're... Demographic's a little young for R. I wonder, but we'll see. Anyhow, tomorrow I go see it at 8 o'clock after work with my District 12 arm bracelet and my District 12 bag and my Mockingjay pen. I'm going to leave the arena wig at home. But
Well, looking forward to hearing what you think of it. But I have to say for myself, I went in with no real expectations, mm-hmm. somewhat lowered expectations, mm-hmm. because... I had heard some things about the third book, people yes. not liking it as much as the first two, and also being wondering, is this really going to be, they're going to find another way to do the Hunger Games a mm. third time around? So for me, I really enjoyed that this revisited that world. It took all the things that I enjoyed about it, but really delved more into the politics and the question of, What do you get behind? Who do you trust?
Yes, who do you trust? Do you keep going this way? Because a lot of what I found when I finished reading the book, and I don't know if I share the same perspective that a lot of people did, but I personally felt traumatized. Not by the author, but by the story. I was physically depressed and tired when I got to the end of it. I know. That being said, I'm wondering if Hollywood is going to go Hollywood at the end, just so I don't have to sit there and take some long therapy baths.
Right. Well, I'll certainly be very curious to see where they go with part two. But mm-hmm. part one, what I would say is I went in wanting more of a kind of young adult level escapist mm-hmm. science fiction.
Yes.
And it delivered. I was entertained. I enjoyed cool. it. I thought it was a solid experience in the theater.
I'm so excited. May the odds be ever in your favor.
And I think with that, we will say thank you very much.
Thank you.
Looking forward to finding out what Trouble thinks after she sees the film.
So excited.
And thank you all for listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
See ya.
Hey, Slice of Sci-Fi, this is Tad Mason calling in. Hey, Summer, thanks a lot for keeping the show alive. Really appreciate it, the last few episodes and everything. Although I would, if you had a nice chance, Mike is that back. I haven't had a good Merkin joke in a while, and I almost listened to episode 220. It's getting that bad, so, if you guys could get back in there and get things going again, it'd be great. Best podcast ever. And Summer, thanks a lot. You're doing a great job. Really appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
Hi, and welcome back to Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And I'm Sean Farrell.
And some of you may recognize Tim as being my former co-host on the Babylon podcast. And Sean is from the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing podcast, which if you haven't checked out, you really should. But we have gathered here today to get through this thing called Doctor Who.
You make it sound like an operation.
Oh, come on. I was channeling Prince for a second. Give me a break.
I caught it.
But yes, Doctor Who Season 8 recently concluded. And from what I've been reading on the internets, because those are never wrong, it's been a lot of mixed feelings. A lot of people who are in the love section, a lot of people in the hate section, not quite so many in the meh section. So talk to us about Season 8 of Doctor Who.
Okay, Season 8 in general. Let me say this. I think of all the modern Doctors, we're talking from when Eccleston took over as number 9 and going forward, Peter Capaldi as 12 is my favorite Doctor.
Really?
Yes. Part of it, only a small part, but part of it is that, shall we say, Peter Capaldi and I are of a similar vintage.
Okay.
It's funny to say that, and like I said, it's not a big part, but it's kind of nice to, as the Doctors got younger and younger, and the companions got younger, and there was sort of a undercurrent of romance through it all. Especially with some of the companions, except for Donna Noble. I'm old enough to be their father. This is kind of a weird vibe. With 12 and Clara Osgood, there's none of that. And that's very refreshing in my mind.
Plus, someone out there is going, Oswald. So I thought I'd...
Okay, whatever.
I know it's happening, so we may as well just say it.
Yeah. No, you're right. That was because I was thinking Osgood, the girl with the inhaler. My mistake.
Right.
I apologize. Yeah. All right, so there. but beyond all that, he's a much different Doctor than the others have been. The other ones have all been certain levels of brooding, but they're all about the immediacy of the moment and trying to save everyone right now. 12 seems to – he approaches everything with a bigger picture, and to make an omelet, sometimes you got to break some eggs.
Mm. One really big egg, the shape of the moon, to be precise.
Right. And this Doctor is also one who, while he is there to protect the Earth, he takes that part of his self-imposed role very seriously. He doesn't suffer fools gladly. And if someone makes a dumb mistake, he will let that person suffer the consequences.
Yeah, I agree. My favorite Doctor, I think, is still David Tennant. I've liked all of them, but none of the Doctors have grabbed me from the beginning. They all kind of took some time to grow on me. Beginning with Eccleston, Tennant I probably liked the most early on. Matt Smith took a while. I just thought it was too goofy at first.
Right.
And then Capaldi, depending on how it's supposed to be said,
I think it's actually Capaldi.
Is it Capaldi? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
When we first see him, when he kind of stumbles out of the TARDIS, I don't mean when he regenerates at the end of last year, but in episode one, Deep Breath, when he stumbles out of the TARDIS and he's kind of out of his mind, he was kind of channeling a little bit of Matt Smith in there, which I thought was nice because I could see a little bit of the transition happening. And of course, he spends much of that episode literally not knowing who he is and going through the regeneration hangover. But the first three episodes, I didn't like at all. I mean, there were moments, they had good moments in them and interesting things, and they were setting up this arc with Heaven and the mistress or Missy, right? But it wasn't until Listen that I finally got hooked in and thought, okay, there's something here with Capaldi that really got me on that one. That was a good episode. And there was an article that came out on Tor.com. I'm not sure exactly when it came out, but it was, let's see, I got it here. Where is it? It was written by Ryan Britt. And the title of it was Fairy Tales No More, Doctor Who's a Science Fiction Show Again. And it really kind of helped. You know, there's a lot of obvious stuff that I just hadn't really thought about. It crystallized for me why this season was different beyond just the fact that the Doctor was different, but that the storytelling itself was changing. And he has this bit where he talks about how all the fantasy tropes that were especially in the Matt Smith years, where you have, you know, Amy's baby being stolen, sort of like this Rumpelstiltskin deal, as he says in the article. Right. The Doctor becomes a legend of the people in the forest, and, you know, the entire universe can be changed by a kiss. And even Matt Smith's first episode, Amelia Pond, like out of a fairy tale, right? So there are all these fairy tale tropes, and Stephen Moffat mentioned it once. Yeah, we kind of use the fairy tale elements to kind of get away with things. You use some sciencey sounding thing, but it's a way to cover up plot holes. And you know, and in this season, it's like the fairy tale is over. It's been broken. And now we have these very much more science fictional stories that we're dealing with. And I think that's true. If you look at the episodes as a whole, I think that holds up.
I'm sitting here just imagining the Moffat and crew sitting in the writer's room saying, there in the writing room saying, okay, now we have this plot hole. Let's spackle it over with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
And that's as much as I enjoyed much of the Matt Smith years, because I think there was a nice emotion. I say nice. There was a powerful emotional component that went on that. And I think that's part of the fairy tale thing. It was clear that in a lot of ways, especially when it came to the big overall arc stories that they told, they took roller coaster writing approach. Let's just go really fast and hope that you don't notice that this doesn't make sense over here.
Right.
And the fact is that the actors did such a compelling job with their characters, in my opinion, that I was willing to overlook that. But this year, again, I guess back to making it more science fiction-y, I really feel like the stories themselves, even when they got a little silly, they were internally consistent, that they worked with the logic that was set up at the beginning of the episode such that it all hung together. And I think that the plotting was tighter. And the dialogue was snappier. And in fact, I really liked the first episode until we first saw Missy. And it was clear that she was going to be this year's arch story. And I was instantly bored with that. It's like, oh, please, can we just cut to the chase with this? Now, to kind of flash forward, I am generally pleased with the payoff, and maybe that's because I had extremely low expectations. But the point of the matter was that all the stories, I didn't feel like, other than those bits with Missy, every story was very nicely self-contained and yet built on other things. I thought the relationship between Danny Pink and Clara was amazing.
And yeah, I agree. It had a lot more emotional resonance for me than the Amy-Rory relationship did.
Right. And as much as Rory is arguably my second favorite companion of all the modern era, I agree with you. There was something that was just sort of contrived with that. And the other part of it that was great with Danny and Clara was that this showed it was what happens after Happily Ever After. It's Clara's the episodes were as much about Clara trying to come to grips with what it means to run around with a madman in a blue box.
Right.
You know, and that was the tension. You know, right. And there's episodes where all of a sudden she realizes she's living a double life. She's living a lie. She wants to have a sweet life as a teacher with this marvelous, loving man in her life who clearly adores her, but she's also enamored with running around with this crazy man and seeing all of space and time. And how can you not refuse that siren call? And it's at the very end when she realizes what she loses. That's when she stops adventuring. When she realizes the price that you pay is that you lose people you love.
I thought the Danny and Clara relationship was really well done. I think what I liked about it is both of them were strong characters. I mean, you were able to have a strong male character where that wasn't jeopardized or threatened by the fact that Clara is a strong female character, right? And besides the fact that she lies to him all the time, which isn't good for a healthy relationship, but I thought it was a nice relationship to see where Clara doesn't have to emasculate Danny in order to present herself as a strong woman, and he's not intimidated by her, and he has the maturity and true like masculinity and security in himself not to be intimidated by any of that. You know, we still, even in science fiction, I don't know if it's a comic book influence or what, but we don't see enough of that. I don't think anyway, where you have pretty well adjusted, well rounded people that aren't hooked on drugs all the time. She's just addicted to traveling with a madman in the blue box. But she even uses
those very words. And I can't remember which episode, but she says she just, you know, and about to debark from the TARDIS after an adventure, she quickly turns on the doctor, says, "Is this an addiction?" Mm-hmm. And he says some of the effect of, "Well, it's only an addiction if you try to quit." You know,
nobody likes a quitter. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But the point is that he can't answer that question because this is how he lives his life.
Right.
And, you know, the other part of it, and this is one of the things that's really, I think, amazing about the writing in this season, is that, as you say, Sean, lying to Danny is not good for a healthy relationship. And he's not mad, really, that she's traveling. He just wants to know.
Mm-hmm.
And when he knows something's up, but she's not coming clean with him, that's where he's bothered by it. But in the end, he understands it. You know, the thing that he doesn't like is the doctor's attitude. And that's the other thing that I loved about Danny Pink, is he's the first human character that really
calls him
out
from the beginning. Mm-hmm. He smelled him like a moldy cheese.
Right. and isn't swept up by his bravado.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah. Rory, you know, he tells the doctor early on, you know, "You don't understand, you know, you make people do dangerous things when they're with you," but then he gets swept up in it too.
Right.
You know, Danny never does. You know, that whole scene where, you know, Clara gives Danny the invisibility watch, it's in the caretaker, and the doctor knows Danny's there, even though he's invisible. And Danny, you know, decloaks, and Clara says, "What you doing?" And he goes, "He knows I'm here. You know, let's not pretend anymore." And there's that whole great conversation where Danny basically calls him out and says, "Look, I know who you are. You're an officer. You tell people what to do, and you think you're doing all these great things, but you're not the one who's got blood on his hands. You're not the one actually pulling the trigger."
Which is interesting, because I was thinking about this so many of the Tennant and Eccleston and Smith years, you know, the doctor is dealing with his grief over what he had to do to end the Time War, right?
Yep.
Well, we know from the 50th anniversary that he didn't actually do that thing that he was grieved about. So when the Capaldi comes around, like, he knows, he has that memory that, okay, that didn't really happen. But it's like he still has the emotional baggage of all those hundreds of years of carrying that guilt around. And so when the insinuations of the, you know, "You're a soldier, you're an officer, you know, you send people to their death, you tell people what to do and they do it," it's almost like it's still that all that history of his is, makes that sting all the more. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but I thought it was an interesting interplay with all that stuff that happened in the anniversary special.
Yeah, yeah. the ultimate episode, the season finale. Mm. I have to say, I was at first kind of put off to see the side. I mean, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. It was like one of those. At first, I didn't quite grasp the emotional core of it. Part of it was I was probably distracted from events of that day, but I was quickly drawn in. And again, to bring it back to what a marvelous job they did with these characters. Spoiler alert, sweetie. We find out that Missy is actually the master regenerated.
Right.
And I loved the actress. I don't recall her name. She's not gone. They'll be bringing her back.
Yeah, they already confirmed that she'll be back.
Okay, good. Because when that one Cyberman blasts her, the way she vanishes looks more like a transmat effect rather than a vaporization kind of thing. But anyways, but her whole deal is she has reincarnated the Cybermen. She has reprogrammed them such that they basically reanimate the dead. And as all these Cybermen are clawing their way out like zombies from graveyards, and the doctor's trying to figure out what's going on, Missy hands him the controls and saying, "You don't get it. This army is for you. So you can do those things. So you can go save planets. So you can go run around and be the hero and blah, blah, blah." But in the end, all she's really trying to say is, when you do this, you're like me, and then we don't have to be alone anymore. Mm. Mm-hmm. All she wants is to have her best friend from childhood back again.
In her own sick, twisted way that only the master would come up with.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. It's totally, totally warped. But it's heartbreaking.
Does the season finale pay off, given that you had said earlier that you didn't like the little side plots with Missy dropped throughout the entire season? Does what happened in the season finale change how you look at those earlier glimpses of her?
Only in the sense of, now I see what they were trying to do and I understand why they had to sprinkle it across the season, because part of what the deal is she's been grabbing people as they die throughout all of history and uploading their consciousness into a Time Lord matrix, if you will. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then once she's got the Cybermen nanobots ready to go to reanimate the dead, then all these people can be downloaded. Their consciousness can now be re-downloaded into their bodies, but still a Cybermen with all the Cybermen motivations and the lack of emotion, sort of. And that was kind of interesting because it wasn't a perfect transfer. But to stay on point with the question, Summer, yeah, now I see why they had to have it in there. One was sort of to kind of tease people along. Well, what's the deal with this? But also to say this has been going on for a long time, so that when she finally appears in all her glory in the two-part finale, it's not as much of a surprise, if you will. But I'm still – it was just so clearly ham-fisted. This is the big secret for the season. Ooh, what does it all mean? It's like, oh, you know, can you just – there was no subtlety to it, not like Bad Wolf.
Right, which was very subtle.
Yes.
Exactly.
Like
Precisely
you really
right.
didn't notice it until the second to the last episode.
The first – yeah, the first two or three times, you know, Bad Wolf flashed by, I didn't even notice it. I literally – it was in the background. It was just there. Yeah. And you go back and you rewatch those episodes and you go – oh, man, really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this was just, like I said, from the first time she showed up, it was like, oh, please. Again, the actress who played Missy was phenomenal. They're on an Air Force One sort of airplane. The doctor's been declared president of Earth because it's a invasion situation, and all the nations of Earth have agreed that the doctor should become president of Earth in that sort of emergency. And so the plane comes apart, blah, blah, blah. Missy comes down out of the clouds like Mary Poppins with the heels together and the umbrella out. Right. And it is just perfect. It was pitch perfect. And she was evil, and she was conniving and manipulative.
Which is great, because I just watched Doctor Who: A Christmas Carol today with my kids. And when Matt Smith's talking to the kid, he says, have you seen Mary Poppins? He goes, no. He goes, well, that's a rubbish analogy anyway. So, see, this has been in Moffat's mind for a couple of years. Everything's bouncing around. Wow. There is one other major thing. See if you guys agree with me or not, okay? And I think Moffat tips his hat to this when he has Clara pretending to be the doctor in the finale, right? And then when the opening credits, you see her face in the universe and her name is first. So I think he's even saying yes. So this season, I think, is the only season of the new series anyway, going back to Eccleston. I haven't watched all of the previous Doctors, so I can't say. But where really the Doctor is not the main character of the season. I think this is the first time that Clara is the main character. The character arc throughout the season is hers. We see it in, what was the episode where the two-dimensional creatures?
Flatline.
Flatline.
Right. What would the doctor do? No, what would I do?
Yes, and she basically has to become the doctor. He's trapped in the TARDIS in her purse, right?
Yeah.
To her physically saying, oh, yes, I am the doctor, and channeling him. But really, I mean, everything we're talking about with Danny Pink and how much of that care, of that relationship was featured. I mean, they got more of their relationship worked out than Amy and Rory got in 2.5 seasons, in my opinion. Because they were just there along for the ride.
Yeah, that's a fair observation, Sean. I agree with you. And certainly it's, again, one where the relationship between the doctor and his companion is on a much different footing. You know, the companion isn't a starry-eyed young lady that's been swept up with the romance of traveling through all of time and space. She is, but part of, like you noted, with the relationship, and as we said earlier, what it's more about is the toll it takes on your personal life. You don't have a life when you're doing that.
Yeah, that episode where she's trying to have the date, just classic.
Yes.
It was just hysterical. And I think that's one reason you felt the writing was better this season. I think Moffat is at his best doing character moments.
Yep. And I also think that he's better when, because I'm looking at the writing credits, there were very few where he was the sole writer. I think he wrote the premiere episode, and I think he wrote these last two. But for the most part, it was given over to other writers, and I think that's part of it too. I think that he let them just tell compelling, interesting stories.
Okay, here's a question for both of you. Knowing what you know about Moffat's twisty little mind and some of the stuff he's plotted over the past several years, do you think that him making the Master, having regenerated as a woman, is a way to ease people into the idea that maybe the Doctor could regenerate as a woman in a future season?
Sean, I have my opinion. What do you say?
Well, look what happened to the poor guy when he became a woman. He was even more psychotic. So I don't know if – no, I'm kidding.
Your wife is going to want to have some words with you, son.
Well, there is one thing I'll note. In a deep breath, when he is going through that time of the post-regeneration and trying to find himself, which was done, I thought, so much better than with the Matt Smiths. I mean, Matt Smith basically walks into a tree and eats fish sticks and custard, and boom, he's fine. Tennant, he was sick and out for a whole episode, you know? So it was nice that we got back to, hey, there's some physical, like, major stuff going on here, and there should be some ramifications to that. So when he's out in the streets and he's looking at his face in a puddle, I think, and he says, that face, I know that face, and why did I have to give myself a hint versus just telling myself what it's all about. Or I don't remember exactly what he said.
Yeah. Why did I choose this face? I believe he said, yeah.
Yes, that he knew that his past self was hinting something to him because he knew this face. And of course, Capaldi also played a role in Torchwood. So his face has been in, and he was in season 3 episode as well, or season 4 episode.
Oh,
it was Donna,
yeah, right?
Right,
cuz it was Donna. You're right. Yep.
Donna the House Gods, yeah. Fires of Pompeii. So there is something going on with that, and I'm assuming, I cannot believe that they're going to let that ball drop, that is coming back up next year. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm interested in seeing, assuming that is part of this regeneration cycle, not something in the future. But it also gives that, we saw this too, the, help me out here, Tim, the movie they did, the two-hour film that was actually in America for the Eighth Doctor. That poor guy only got the 2 hours, and that was
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
The Fox movie. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, where Eric Roberts was the bad guy.
Yes.
But there is this implication.
And Paul McGann's wearing that horrible wig.
Paul McCann. Yes, thank you. When they did the webisode where he became the War Doctor.
Yes.
We got very clear sense that the Time Lords do have some control over who they become.
Right.
He was able to choose who he became. This regeneration gives us a hint. Hey, Matt Smith knew who the next iteration is going to be. Capaldi confirms it by saying, why did he just give me this hint?
Right.
So I've always wondered if they're leaving that door open to bring an old doctor back into the role. I don't know if they would ever do something like that. But why couldn't you have David Tennant come back or Matt Smith come back and play the part again?
Or go really old school.
Or go really old school, sure.
Wow.
You know, the Day of the Doctor, the curator at the art museum seemed to imply that he was actually the Doctor.
Right? I never knew how his run ended on the show, so I didn't know how to put that in context.
Yeah, he, like other doctors, and it's been a long, long time. So I'm sure somebody out there will send out an email going, you idiot. No, it was like this. but he was dying. Mm. That doctor was dying, and that's what prompted the regeneration.
Now, he was dying of sickness, of old age?
No, wounds. I think if memory serves, like I said, it was a long, long time ago. If memory serves, through whatever happened in the adventure, he was mortally wounded.
Okay.
Yeah, and so he regenerated. Now, the other thing that I have read is that people may note the fact that Capaldi played a role in the Fires of Pompeii, and Moffat sort of did a wink, wink, nudge, nudge and said, yep, we know that Capaldi played that character, hinting that there might be a tie-in back to that.
Back to that story?
Yes. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm really okay with the fact that they got this actor. He did a good job in Fires of Pompeii, and so they auditioned him to play the Doctor, and he got the role. I really don't need... I don't need it all explained.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's same thing with Enterprise. They spent 2 hours explaining why some Klingons have head ridges and some don't. I don't care. It's an explanation enough that Gene Roddenberry had $50 for the makeup budget in 1967. Okay.
Well, here's another hint for you. The role that Capaldi did before Doctor Who, he played a Who Doctor in World War Z. So there you go. So it must be the zombie apocalypse.
Well, they were cyber zombies in a sense.
Yeah, there you go. It all fits.
Summer, back to your question about the master regenerating a mistress. I think it's more to take the heat off.
Huh.
Aren't going to be the questions of, you know, when will we have a female doctor? He'll say, look, we've already established the fact that Time Lords can change gender. The Master is now a woman, and we're just going to get the best actor we can to play the role. And they're just going to leave it at that. I think that was more a move to take the heat off rather than to set up for the future.
I would love if they had a female doctor, though.
Well, they, in a sense, they did. Did you ever see the... oh, I can't remember the name of it. It was a special is done for children in need, and it had Rowan Atkinson in it as playing the doctor.
Rowan Atkinson.
And I'm gonna have to look this up while we're talking. And it was a parody, but he was clearly the doctor, and in the end he regenerates into Joanna Lumley.
I never did see that, no, but I'm going to look
that
up. No,
I missed that one, too.
Hang on, I'm...
The things we learn.
Yeah.
Doctor Fury. Okay, yes, it is Doctor Who and the Curse of Fatal Death. It's very amusing, and
what year was that?
March of 1999. And this was it was for a charity telethon, and I'm reading through the Wikipedia here.
So that was a couple of years after the
it
Fox.
It was during the hiatus. Yeah,
it was after the Fox fiasco.
Fox fiasco was the same year, if I remember right.
I thought it was like 97.
You might be right, actually, Summer.
I don't remember. I remember tape recording it on my VCR because I couldn't watch it.
1996. Yeah, you're right.
96. So I wanted to watch it, and I started watching it and was like, yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. yeah, Jim Broadbent's in that. Hugh Grant is in it.
Wow.
Jonathan Pryce played the Master. There were Daleks in it. Yeah.
Jonathan Pryce as the Master. Ooh, that's...
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's out on YouTube. It's well worth watching. It's silly and
I have
lowbrow, but it's still very entertaining.
I have a pathological urge to avoid Rowan Atkinson, so I will have to pass.
That's Mr. Bean, isn't it?
Yeah, one of my cousins was a huge Mr. Bean fan, and I could not. I literally almost threw the kid into a closet just to be able to turn off the TV. So,
yeah, Stephen Moffat wrote this as well, for what that's worth. Huh.
Seriously,
yeah. Wow! Is there any Doctor Who Moffat hasn't written? My goodness!
I think you're probably right about that. Yeah.
So do you guys have any final thoughts or expectations?
I'm really interested to see what happens in the next season or series, as our British friends would say. The last scene leaves one with the impression that Missy was lying about Gallifrey, and also that Clara is finished with her. She's thoroughly disillusioned and she's heartbroken, and she is finished with traveling with the doctor. And so it's all up in the air. And I think that's really interesting, because I can't say that of all the modern doctors, I don't know that things have been left in such a...
In such disarray?
Yeah, disarray is a good word for it. You know, they've left it with chaos, and they've left it with cliffhangers and all that. But this is definitely, there's disillusion and disarray. You know, it was a very downbeat note. And I find that very oddly refreshing, because now it means that where they've explored taking this character with the new actor, with Peter Capaldi, I see them stretching their legs and trying even more and different things with it. And they'll confound some fans. I have every reason to think that'll happen, but for the first time, I really feel like they're heading in a new and different direction. I think there's some very interesting things on the horizon.
I share that sentiment. Now, I did see a 2-minute preview of the Christmas special in which Clara is having a conversation with Santa. And the doctor comes and asks Clara to get into the TARDIS, and then looks at Santa and says, "I know what's really going on here." And he's like, "Do you, doctor?" You know. So, now, but Santa makes a comment to Clara. Clara says, you know, I don't believe in you because I don't believe in fairy tales. And he goes, don't you? And then the doctor appears. So it's almost like they're tipping their hat to that fairy tale storytelling again. I'm hoping they don't go too far with that in the Christmas special. I would love Clara to be back as the companion next year. I would like to see what they can do with a relationship that is so strained by the loss of Danny, where they have to live with the consequences of what occurred. To me, it's a bit of an out to just say, well, the pain is too much. She's not going to be on the show anymore. When you have such an incredible opportunity to explore what that means, not just for them individually, but for their relationship, for the consequences of the morality of what they're doing. So I would love some of that. And I agree, Tim, I think the show's going in a different place than it's been, certainly in the last, between seasons 2 and season 7. I'm not sure what would have happened if Eccleston had stayed on board, because his palate, if you will, as an actor was so deep, and he could do some things. He's a special actor. But the one thing I hope I never see on Doctor Who ever again is a golden arrow being fired 500 yards into the air, sticking into the side of a ship and magically giving it enough power to get into orbit before it explodes. That was just too stupid. I couldn't take it.
That was one, though. Yes, yes. Absolutely agree with you. But I liked it because I liked that episode, again, more for the character beats.
Yes, because I was trying to get the urine sample from the Merry Men. Love that. Yes. Hysterical.
Yes. And when he's talking with the Sheriff of Nottingham and saying, I know what you're doing and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, what are you talking about? I just want to take over London. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, the doctor, because he thinks in cosmic scales, can't comprehend that bad guys aren't thinking that way as well.
Right.
You know, I mean, he's but I also liked it because at the end, when Robin is talking with the doctor and, you know, he says, you know, you think it's hard to believe a man of noble birth, you know, throws off his birthright to travel and save those less fortunate than him. Mm. And he says, you know, and the doctor says, you know, well, you know, we all know that's your story. And Robin goes, no, I'm talking about you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that moment of what is a hero really? You know, is it a legend? Is it something else? You know, and the fact of the matter is that we have heroes, but in reality, they're all flawed individuals. And this doctor is very flawed, but flawed in interesting, compelling, and believable ways.
Well, then we see in the very next episode, Listen, where we go back to the doctor's childhood and see that the man he is born out of those flaws and out of those fears.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great episode.
So I'm willing to deal with the occasional golden arrow into the spaceship because, you know, all right, fine. You know, that's kind of old school Doctor Who too. You know, I mean, that's part of its DNA as well. The fact is that I think the problem with previous seasons is that those big arcs were lots of those sorts of golden arrows, you know, but anyways.
Well, it sounds like we still have a lot more Doctor Who to look forward to next season. And I think we should get together again and do this after the Christmas special, just because I'm sure you guys could talk 2 hours on a 1 hour special.
Yes, I'm sure we could.
I'm all for it.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys for joining me this evening to talk literally wall-to-wall Doctor Who. And that'll do it for this episode of Slice with Sci-Fi. I want to thank Noah in Trouble again for their review of The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1. If you want to leave a comment, feel free to call 602-635-6976. Or you could email in a comment you've recorded yourself. That's summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can join in the conversations over on Facebook. It's facebook.com/sliceofscifi. We do have a Google Plus presence. And of course, you can find myself or sometimes Jeffrey on Twitter. Again, thanks to everybody who's continued to support us during this interesting year. And we'll be back next week with more Slice of Sci-Fi.